and welcome to the Off the Charts Football Podcast for this week. I'm Mark Simon, joined by SAS VP of Football, Matt Manicharian, and two of our NFL scouting experts from our ops department, Ben Herkosh and Jeff Dean. For those of you who listened last week, we talked about process and evaluation. We looked at four high-end NFL prospects, explained our process for grading them, and graded those players. This week, we'll do something similar. But first, the big news in the NFL was the franchise quarterback movement. Let's start with the trade. Russell Wilson to the Broncos. The Seahawks get a haul of players and picks back. The Broncos think they have a quarterback who can win them the Super Bowl. Matt, what's your evaluation of the deal?
What's up, Mark? It's good to be back after a week at the Combine. Certainly big news here. And unfortunately, this is one where I think deals are rarely about obvious winners and losers. I know everybody likes to frame things like that. And sometimes we do get that opportunity. But in this case, I think this was an exchange of present value for future value, which is really how most deals end up working. Whatever sport you're talking about, team sports, that tends to be what's in exchange. So I think clearly Broncos have potential to become real contenders right away. They have as good a group of skill position players, even losing Fant, as you see in most teams around the league. They've been built well on defense for a while. Hopefully they can keep that together. And they get a legitimate Super Bowl quarterback. So I think that this is just them moving in the direction of trying to win now, like we saw with the Rams last year, and the Seahawks taking a little bit of a step back.
Do you have any concerns? I was looking yesterday at our total points for the season, both on a per-play basis and on a full-season basis. And Russell Wilson was outside the top 10 in total points per play, total points being our flagship stat, where we're measuring everything and allotting value to different players depending on the results that take place in the execution. Or is the excuse for that that he played a couple of games not fully healed from his injury and that in all reality, he is a top 10 quarterback for sure.
What underlies what you're saying is that total points at the end of the day is a descriptive stat. It's got a little like kind of parts of it that are sort of predictive that are built into there. But at the end of the day, this is describing what's happened. And this was not a great offense. So there are a few things that definitely played into where he ranked in total points last year. But we're talking about one of the worst seasons of Russell Wilson's career in a year where in 14 games, he had 25 touchdowns and 6 interceptions. That's a pretty good worst year, right? We're talking about his lowest points above average per play in the total points era. And he was still above average, right? He was still in the top half of the league where we put such a premium on this position. So even as a part of a passing game that created negative expected points added as a whole, he was still performing at an above average level. This was not an offense that was conducive to his success. There was, like you said, the injury thing was a real problem for him this year. But this is a clear win with quarterback. You know how I like to talk about quarterbacks. He's been a win with quarterback, literally. The Seahawks won a Super Bowl in large part because Russell Wilson helped them get them there and helped them win that game. Now, win because of is something that I think he's flirted with at times in his career. I think early 2020, Russell Wilson, before you know that whole thing got blown up and they went in a different direction offensively than they had from the beginning of that year. But he's flirted with that being a win because of type guy. So this to me is a great deal for the Broncos. And I don't have any concerns about Russell Wilson. I think they know exactly what they're getting for several years to come.
Even at age 32, 33, with all the sacks that he's taken?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about Russell Wilson and the sacks and the pressures and the style of play, because I think that's a big part of this too. When you're talking about him, you're talking about a smaller quarterback in terms of height. You're not really talking about a smaller quarterback in terms of this is a guy that's got a thick build to him. He's taking care of his body, who's shown the ability to kind of withstand a bit of a beating. You know, the thing this year was a finger. That's not going to be something that anybody's going to be able to control for. I don't care if you're 7 feet tall and 400 pounds. The thing about the way that Russell Wilson plays is he will try to run things in structure a bit of the time. I think early in his career, he was more of an in-structure quarterback. But as time has gone on, and one of the things that's really made him special is the way that he breaks things down outside of structure. So after he gets past the first read, after he gets past the second read, what does he do to extend the play? What does he do to keep things alive? A lot of his best throws are on the run after he's extended the play, keeping his eyes downfield. And then also he's done a bunch of damage with his legs throughout the course of his career. So what does that mean? That means that he's going to be under pressure more often, right? Because he's holding on to the ball, it's going to create situations where no matter who his offensive line is, and it hasn't been great in Seattle, and it's probably not great what he's coming into in Denver, although it's gotten better over the last couple of years. But he's somebody that's going to elevate the pressure rate on his own as the quarterback. But along with that, he's somebody that's going to excel under pressure, which totally bucks the trend that you see from almost every other quarterback in the NFL. Most quarterbacks perform worse under pressure than they do under a clean pocket. That stands to reason. Well, sometimes Russell Wilson is trying to get into those pressure situations exactly for this reason, exactly to have the play break down so he can find Tyler Lockett there. So I don't worry about Broncos' ability to protect him any more so than I did the Seahawks' ability to protect him. I think he'll do best when he's with a well-rounded offensive line because he is a short quarterback. And when you don't have the play action game, it becomes a harder thing for him to make those middle of the field throws. But all things considered, he's been that height his whole career. He hasn't had a great offensive line for the last several seasons. And I don't have a lot of reasons to be concerned about Russell Wilson's it being exactly what the Broncos are looking for at that position.
And what does the deal mean for the Seahawks?
So the Seahawks, you know, a couple interesting ways to look at it. First thing that comes to mind is, man, they basically got similar draft capital in exchange for Russell Wilson than they gave up for Jamal Adams. That sounds like bad business to me. We have to take those as two separate deals. That doesn't make this deal a bad deal. But man, when you look back on that and to be saying that you'd be sacrificing this kind of a player at that position for draft capital mostly, when you were willing to give that up in order to get Jamal Adams a couple years ago, that feels like a miscalculation to me. Now, again, present value versus future value. At that time, they thought they were in their window. Now they're clearly past their window. What it means for the Seahawks is Bobby Wagner now finished his career as a Seahawk. He's been as important to their defense as Russell Wilson's been to their offense. They've got two new signal callers. They're going to have new signal callers on both sides of the ball next year. This is a rebuilding phase. And Pete Carroll didn't want to build around a win because of quarterback. He wanted to build around the rest of his team. He wanted to build around his defense. He wanted to build around a running game and have a quarterback like Russell Wilson did early in his career who could come in and complement that. I think he's going to try to get back to that. I think I'd be surprised if he invested a lot in a quarterback right now, because when you look at kind of the shape of this team, I do think they're probably in a bit of a, hate to say rebuilding phase, but a little bit more future value oriented than they have been for the duration of Russell Wilson's career.
Right. And they were 7-10 and the NFC West was pretty ridiculous this year. So the other move, Packers get another dose of Aaron Rodgers. He's going to sign for 4 years. Thoughts on that?
Aaron Rodgers is two-time reigning MVP. He's one of the best players in the NFL. He's old, but I don't think that they're going to have to pay him for any seasons that he doesn't play, right? If anybody calls it quits, it's going to be Aaron Rodgers. I don't know if they've come out with the official details of this. I know there was some reported stuff that had basically 3 years and $150 million of it guaranteed. And then Rodgers said that's not the details. So who knows as far as that goes. But if that is the case, that means number one, the Packers actually get some salary cap relief this year. They franchise Devontae Adams. He'll be back along with Aaron Rodgers. That's almost half of their salary cap right there, just between, or about a third of their salary cap between just those two guys. But I don't have any concerns about guaranteeing 3 years for Aaron Rodgers. I think it's honestly a no-brainer. I can think that, you know, some of the stuff with Aaron Rodgers that ventures outside of the football field, you know, but in terms of on the field, there's a reason why they understand he's one of the best players in football. They saw Tom Brady win the Super Bowl 2 years ago. They saw Matthew Stafford change the Rams. I think they understand the value of Aaron Rodgers, and I don't think they want to find out how many games they would win without him. I think Matt LaFleur is plenty happy winning 13 games a year and not finding out what it's like on the other side.
And the other quarterback maneuvering, Colts get the Commanders to take on Carson Wentz's whole deal. Didn't see that coming. So Wentz was 12th among quarterbacks in total points last season. He actually could have easily been in the top 10. How does he fit in DC?
Yeah, I think 12th in total points last season probably has something to do with the volume that he got there and some other things going on. In reality, this was somebody who I think frustrated the Colts all year long. I think that it was evident just from watching on the field. In his own right, I don't think he's somebody that really came in and was able to kind of run the offense in the way that they want to, which is super shocking because you would think Frank Reich would have known exactly what he was getting into with Carson Wentz. But this is a clear Indy taking an L, ready to move on. They saw the sunk costs and they said, this isn't what's going to get us to where we need to go. So they moved on as far as that goes. I strongly, strongly would be surprised if he's the type of quarterback that gets the Commanders to where they want to go. But, you know, if the Commanders are thinking, we'll do this, try to see him as some sort of a bridge with a chance, you know, with the upside that we've seen before. So maybe you can get the upside there. If they think he's better than any option that's available in the draft, which we'll be talking about coming up with Jeff and Ben, you know, you can understand, I guess it's not a super high. It's not like they took on all of the contract and they didn't give up a first round pick for him. They feel like they're upgrading their team. Certainly. I don't think it's a big needle mover for Washington. And I think for the Colts, this is kind of a mea culpa. This is kind of, we swung and missed on that one, and we're going to figure this out a different way now. I wouldn't be surprised if they went after somebody. Like I said, I would be surprised if the Seahawks went after a big name quarterback. I would not be surprised if the Colts brought in somebody established.
Like who?
That's a good question. There are a couple of names out there on the free agency side of things. You know, you're talking about Jameis Winston and some guys like that. Everybody's always going to have some sort of a wart when it comes to free agency. I think that'd be interesting, but I think also the trade market, like we just saw with Russell Wilson, like we saw a year ago with Matthew Stafford. I hear things about Garoppolo that I wouldn't be moved by that if I was Indianapolis, but maybe they have a different feel for things. So I think we just got to sit back and keep enjoying our popcorn as the offseason unfolds, because this is the fun stuff, right?
And from here, we move to the NFL draft, and we're going to talk NFL draft prospects. We bring in Ben Herkosh and Jeff Dean. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Mark. Good to be here.
Cool. We appreciate you guys both joining us. And just to reintroduce a few things from last week to kind of set the parameters for what these two guys are going to talk about, we're preparing a football rookie website, be available online at the end of the month. 300 plus players evaluated both statistically and through scouting, which is their specialty. Our film watchers, Jeff and Ben among them, watch at least 4 games of film on every guy they watch and key in on their guys, grading them on critical factors and positional factors. The final grade is generally from 5.4 to 9. The higher, the better, of course. And decimals matter. There's a difference between 6.4 and 6.6 that's notable. We're going to go through a few players here with them. Last week, we talked about quarterback, running backs, cornerbacks, and offensive line. Today, we're going to start with a wide receiver. And Ben, introduce us to Sky Moore from Western Michigan.
Yes, Sky Moore, Western Michigan wide receiver. He actually, interestingly, he was a quarterback and defensive back all of high school, and he's only a 3-year player coming out in this draft. So he's a guy that we certainly look at with a bunch of upside. A very tough, tough player, a little bit undersized in terms of height, but he has a good build below the waist and came in actually at 195 pounds at the combine, which kind of surprised some people. Very sturdy player and incredibly quick and sudden.
So there are 3 critical factors for a receiver. And we talked about this last week, how we have critical factors that are particularly important when you guys try to come up with a grade. For a receiver, they're fairly clear cut, which is nice. Hands, separation, and run after catch is all seems self-explanatory for a football fan. Walk us through here where Moore rates in these.
I know Coop and John Todd talked a little bit about our scale last week, how 5 is sufficient in terms of someone that's getting you by at the NFL level. I gave Sky Moore a 6 for all 3 of those categories, meaning that he's better than most players at the NFL level. Like I said before, he is a kind of raw player. He has flashes of 7 throughout his entire game, but the consistency I don't think will be there week 1 of year 2, which is how we evaluate everyone.
So what's the difference between 6 and 7? Like, tangibly, that I could see with my eye?
Yeah, a 6 is a guy who's just constantly looks a little bit better than everyone else. So if you hate the wide receiver on your team, chances are he's probably a 5 and he's just not doing enough for you. A 6 is a guy that you say, I like him on my team, I might go get his jersey. A 7 is a guy who will win games by himself, certainly is constantly on NFL Network, ESPN, and all those.
I like that. That's a very basic kind of explanation of it, but that's cool. All right. So you went 6s across the board with him in those 3 areas. Like, what do you look for when you're looking for something like separation?
The separation kind of is one of the easier ones because you are literally looking for the space between him and the defender. One of the more difficult things, this is a player that plays in the MAC. So the guys that he's going up against will not be playing on Sundays. So I really harp on those tough games. Last year, they played Michigan and Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is a team that's been putting defensive backs in the NFL for years now. Michigan, obviously, is one of the highest recruiting best teams in the country. And he was lighting them up. I mean, he was giving them work the entire game. He got hurt in the Michigan game, which was disappointing. But up until the point that he went out, he looked like the best player on the field.
Okay, so now with positional factors, lot more of these, or like 10, 11 of these, depends on the position, but usually between like 9 and 12, depending on the spot. What's one in which Moore stands out, and what's one where he's maybe, as you said, where you would be like a five, where you would be kind of like, looking for better here.
Yeah, without a doubt, his release at the line of scrimmage is his best quality. I would thought about going eight. Eight is kind of a grade that I haven't gone near. That is someone that is an all pro level at something instantly, but he is for sure a seven. You see a lot of these wide receivers nowadays, no matter how quick and kind of talented they are, they don't get off of the line of scrimmage well. They don't really know how to play the defender and all of that. Sky Moore, he is just an absolute stud at beating the guy right off the snap. He knows how to change his speeds well. He knows how to attack the leverage that he's presented with. He can fight well against jams. A lot of these smaller receivers get jammed at the line of scrimmage. I actually put in my report that he looks like Mayweather against the jam. His defensive skills and dodging is incredible. And he really, for a player especially that doesn't have too much experience at it, he looks like a savvy veteran in that sense.
And just to clarify, Floyd Mayweather?
Like Mayweather, the way he defends, if you watch boxing at all, Mayweather, the best defensive boxer of all time, I think, he looks like that, the way he kind of takes the little blows and he's already upfield past guys.
Yeah, Mark, and I think that the stats really back this up, because when you look at somebody like Sky Moore, and you're talking about Western Michigan, this isn't just somebody who's been a big play threat, you know, the old school stats, the yards per reception, or even yards per target. We look at things in terms of yards per route run, and even better, total points per route run. This is somebody who ranks 3.6 yards per route run. That's 10th in the entire nation, the entire FBS, every single team, and then third in total points per route run. And when you get down to that level, that starts to show you that he's not just being good when he's targeted. He's getting targeted a lot because he's getting open. And that speaks to the release that Ben's talking about there.
Yeah, he was incredibly productive last year too. 2020, Western Michigan had a receiver, Dwayne Eskridge, got drafted second round by the Seattle Seahawks. And I thought Sky Moore was by far the best receiver on that team.
So what was your final grade for him?
I ended up going with a 6.4 on him. So the way that works for our scale is, I believe week one of year two, he's going to be a slot receiver. I do think he has much more upside than that, and I enjoyed watching him in general. I just think that's his best fit. We ran into this issue last year too with players like Elijah Moore and Kadarius Toney, where the talent is amazing and you want them on your team, but where they fit within the scheme, we put him as a 6.4.
So what would he have needed to have been, like a 6.5 or a 6.6?
The height for sure, and the ability to stand up on the outside as a true number one receiver.
Yeah, that's the key thing about the grading scale, Mark, is what we're trying to do is not just figure out how good the players are, but figure out what roles they're going to fill on our NFL football teams. So if you're a receiver that can only play on the inside at a high level on the NFL, at a starting caliber level, that's going to limit your grade to a 6.4. Whereas once we have guys that can play on the outside, then we start to talk about the 6.7s and above, unless we think that the guy is just a super special, a 7.0 or above level player at that Pro Bowl level. Then, you know, if you can only do one thing, but you can do it on that level, and, you know, that's doing anything at that level is doing anything at that level. And you can make an argument that Elijah Moore will get himself there based on what he put together last year. We'll see if Sky Moore can match Elijah Moore after that, too.
What's the hardest thing to evaluate with a wide receiver and try and project?
For sure, the competition that they go against. Defensive backs, there is very few defensive backs going into the NFL at a high level, which means there's even less at the college level, and then there's even less in the MAC. So to find Sky Moore going against the guys that he will go against on Sundays was difficult, which is why we do try to watch those bigger games. So this is a player that dominated against his competition, showed up against higher teams, and I believe that'll translate to the next level.
Jeff, let's stay on the offensive side. We'll look at Isaiah Likely, a tight end from Coastal Carolina. I like they were giving the smaller schools some attention here. That's cool. Give us a capsule on who he is.
Like you mentioned, Isaiah Likely is the H tight end in Coastal Carolina's offense, which basically means he's the guy they go out there to get catches all over the field. You know, they'll line him up in the slot, in the backfield, as an inline tight end. He's an extremely versatile player, and he's had a great career for Coastal Carolina. He was at the NFL Combine, measuring at 6'4 and a half, 245, so a good size. He also had the 10-inch hands, so he's got massive vice grip hands, and that shows on the field, which is great when the measurables match up to what you see on the field. It's really kind of a great feeling.
Hey, Jeff, I want to just make sure that we're not leaving anybody behind here. You mentioned that he's their H tight end. We should also talk about the corollary to that, the Y tight end. What's a good way that we can explain to people kind of one in relation to the other? Because these are really two different positions within an offense that you'll see. You know, when you're in your 12 personnel, you have both of these players at your disposal. Y being more the inline tight end, the more traditional kind of old school way that we think of the tight end in a three-point stance connected on the line of scrimmage. Like you mentioned, the H tight end, more the move guy. So that's what we're talking about with this player here.
So H tight end is the guy out in space, the guy that's going to be looked for on third downs and in the red zone to catch balls kind of all over the field. Travis Kelce, obviously one of the best H tight ends there is out there. That's kind of the guy you're looking for, somebody that's going to go as a primary target for a quarterback. The Y tight end is the tight end that's brought in to block and handle the bigger defensive linemen. Sometimes you get guys that can play both roles, which is always beneficial, but a lot of times those Y tight ends aren't always your best receiving option. They're more known for the dirty run game. Vikings, if you take a look at their tight ends, Irv Smith would be their H tight end, the guy that's going to go out and, you know, catch balls, the guy that it gets the highlight plays. And before this last year, Tyler Conklin was their Y, the guy they brought in for blocking and handling the defensive ends. However, this year he kind of had to step into both roles with Irv Smith out.
Great comp.
So the critical factors for a tight end, because again, you don't know how a team's going to use them. You're going to want a guy who can certainly be capable of certain things: blocking ability, receiving ability, and then what we call FBI, which is football intelligence. How does likely rate in each of those use the scale that Ben brought up earlier, and we can analogize the same way that he did?
Sure. Likely has a 5 in blocking ability and football intelligence, and a 7 in receiving ability. So this, I think, is a pretty good encapsulation of what kind of player he is. He's a guy that can block in the NFL and understands his assignment, but that's not what you're drafting him for. You're not drafting him to come in and manhandle the guys online and use his size to dominate those players. What you are drafting him for is his receiving ability. He has receiver-like ability to stretch the field, which is hard to find in a tight end. He is willing to beat guys over the top and down the sideline. Areas of the field, you know, that tight ends prefer to sit kind of 5 yards from the line of scrimmage and run short routes to get the quarterback the ball, but he's willing to go all the way over the field and catch balls over the receiver. He's got a great feel for how defenders play him. He's a true mismatch out in space. It's a really unique player who's perfectly suited for today's NFL.
So within the positional factors, of which we mentioned that there are an abundance, what's one area where he stands out?
His hands. That's, you know, it's a really, really nice thing when your tight end is just going to always catch the ball, and that's what he's known for. If you throw it at him, he's coming down with it. He's got a good catch radius. He's got, like I said, 10-inch hands earlier. He's got big vice grip hands and can win against the smaller DBs if they put him on there, and he's too fast to keep up with most linebackers. He'll put some distance between them, so he's going to be a tough guy to guard out in the open space.
And where does he have room to grow?
It's going to be on the blocking aspect. He's a little light on his frame. His overall weight isn't bad, but he's a little thin, what we call light in the pants. He needs to add a little lower body strength to be able to handle those NFL guys. Similar to Sky Moore, Western Michigan, playing at Coastal Carolina, he didn't go against a lot of top-end, big physical defensive ends there. And he was able to dominate defensive backs and smaller players, which is good to see, which we want to see. But when he was forced to block guys that, you know, kind of had a little muscle or size on him, he kind of looked, you know, pedestrian at times. He's going to need to clean that up. He needs to make sure he stays square. But again, you know, if he can figure that out, he could have the potential to be a really devastating mismatch in the NFL.
Yeah, this is a guy who is second in yards per route run amongst tight ends. I mean, you look across the board at the advanced stats, and he's somebody that not just produced on a play-in and play-out basis on a, you know, the per route run level, but also when he was targeted, 67% positive plays when targeted. That's not just caught, but actually creating a positive play. 30% boom rate to just a 9% buffs rate. So somebody who's creating big plays as well. Exciting player to look at as a prospect. Another small school guy. And going back just to those critical factors, there's a reason why football intelligence is a critical factor for tight ends. Being able to learn both aspects of the game in terms of being able to fit in the blocking game in both the run game and the pass game, and then also how to fit into the passing game as a receiver. You're basically having to learn all the offense that the offensive line and that the wide receivers have to learn. So there is a learning curve there. You can expect a player like this to come in. Jeff, tell me if I'm reading it right, but sounds like a player like this would come in more of a role-based thing, really just limited to the H role, trying to give you some upside in that direction. And then maybe as you get deeper into the career, then he develops into maybe more of a well-rounded tight end.
Absolutely. That's exactly how I'd phrase it. I think he's got NFL ready day one H tight end potential. And if he can round out his body type and get into better blocking scenarios and put himself in a position to succeed in that role as well, I think he's got a chance to be a top end NFL tight end.
Well, that's where we get now to your final grade for him. My guess, just from listening to you speak, is somewhere in the range of 6'4", 6'5".
Yeah, it's pretty close. 6'6", lower end starter is what that breaks down to. And again, as we kind of just talked about, he's got the potential to come in on third downs and be a really versatile weapon who you can count on the receiving game. I think he's a little farther away than a year away from actually being able to handle the blocking responsibilities that come with that tight end role. Part of the reason Isaiah likely had a lot of success at Coastal Carolina was when they put him out in space, it was able to get him away from some of those linemen, and they could bring in another tight end on the line to kind of take care of that role. So if he's able to clean up some of those aspects, he's got a lot of potential. But from a day one of season two perspective, we're looking at a lower end starter.
Mark, one positional factor that I love to talk about for tight ends, it's not a critical factor because it's not a necessity, but it's maybe the most important positional factor, is mismatch ability. And that's what Jeff's talking about there. And that's why he will come in and have a role, despite the fact not being able to get up into that ideal starting level grade range before his second year, when you're talking about that 6'7" and above.
Here's a question then off of that. How many plays do you watch to get a number for that specific, for mismatch ability?
That usually takes a few games because the competition they're going against, like we mentioned a little earlier, isn't always great, but it's also the type of players they'll try to throw at them. So, you'll have teams that try to put a faster linebacker on them and hope that works. Other teams maybe don't have that luxury and they have to bring down a big safety or something like that to kind of help neutralize him in the passing game. But yeah, he really excels all over the field. He's got the size to body up linebackers, and with the speed and footwork at the top of his routes to create some separation. But then when you put him against a defensive back, it's just really tough for them to actually get in position when he catches everything that comes to him. He's tough to guard.
Let's shift to the defensive side. We've got a guy for each of you, so we'll bring Ben back. And Ben, your other guy is Jaquan Brisker, safety from Penn State. Give us the overview on him.
Yeah, Jaquan Brisker is a guy who just checks every single box and comes in pretty much NFL ready. As a Penn State grad, this is a person that I've been watching for a while. He actually started at a JUCO at Lackawanna College. He didn't have any offers really coming out of high school, had to prove himself, came to Penn State. And the day he came to Penn State, he was a leader of the defense immediately. He is just a person that fits the bill physically, mentally, and emotionally.
So do you like him?
I do. I do like him. I don't see him as much of a upside person. I think he is a player who is what he is coming in day one, but I see him as an immediate starter and player for a team. I also see him as someone who could set the tone for a maybe young team, a team that doesn't have a defense that kind of sticks together. He certainly shows leadership and kind of coach on the field ability.
So there are three critical factors for safeties. We kind of talked about FBI already, football intelligence and instincts, play speed's another. And then how about explaining out three-level impact for us?
Yeah, so three-level impact went with a 7 overall, which is very good. Three-level impact means that he can literally affect the game at three levels. The deep end, the kind of second-level linebacker in the box, and then also playing behind the line of scrimmage. And he is a player who could do all of those things. One of the deficiencies is kind of his longest speed. So I don't see him as much as a true center fielder, like an Ed Reed type, but he has enough speed to stick with most players. And then he really will make his impact near the line of scrimmage.
Where did you have him in the other two critical factors? Just so we get that too.
So I went for a 7 on FBI and instincts as well. And then a 6 for play speed.
Okay. So 2 7s and a 6. So I can see where this is going. This is heading towards a top end prospect. Certainly there are positional factors too. We mentioned that there are a whole bunch. I'm not going to go through everyone. What's one where he stands out, one where he has some room to grow?
One that he stands out, I think, is man coverage. A lot of what Jeff just talked about with the mismatches in tight ends, you need players that can match up with these tight ends that run routes like wide receivers, but are the size of smaller offensive linemen. Jaquan Brisker is 6'1", 200 pounds. He has long arms, and he also has the foot quickness and loose hips to stick with anybody in the slot. So when you think of all these sub packages that are coming in and one-on-one mismatch football that we have going on now, he kind of is the positionless player where he can do something on first and second down, and then on third down, immediately take a different role.
That sounds like a very valuable kind of player to have. What's an area of growth for him?
This is a very well-rounded player. I did mention his long speed. He isn't the fastest person. He was never a track guy or anything like that. He wins a lot with anticipation and his first step quickness. So if he does find himself maybe not in the correct position, you could see these burners running past him deep.
So last year in the Football Rookie Handbook, we had Trevon Moehrig as a 6'9", and then we had a whole bunch of safeties who graded 6'7". A 6'9 is a strong starter who plays on all three downs. 6'7 is as well, but that's kind of the lower end of it.
Who were the 6'7s?
Ardarius Washington, Javon Holland, Paris Ford, Andre Sisco, Richard LeCount.
Javon Holland was pretty good.
So I'm guessing that he fits somewhere in there. What did you have for him as his final grade?
Yeah, I actually have him at a 6'8", so I have him right in the middle there. I think this is a guy who is an incredibly valuable player. He is not an all-pro type, maybe not a Pro Bowl right away, but he's going to be your leader on defense. And I think in a draft without a Kyle Hamilton, he's in the discussion for top safety in the draft.
It's pretty impressive. That's a strong grade on him there, but clearly you've studied the player.
With that done, let's bring Jeff back to look at another defensive player, Devin Lloyd. I saw a headline that said that he might be the draft's most NFL-ready linebacker. So I'm guessing that this is going to go similar to the conversation that we just had on Brisker. Introduce us to the linebacker from Utah.
Yeah, about to describe my favorite player in this NFL draft, Devin Lloyd. He's played receiver and safety in high school, so he's a kind of a really unique prospect. He started, catching the ball and being able to run over everybody, and then he put on a lot of weight and was able to still keep that athleticism at Utah. He was actually the 2021 AP Defensive Player of the Year, so he's not a guy that's going to fly under the radar. Everybody knows who he is. He's a guy that it was a will linebacker in Utah's system, but really he did everything they asked. He had 22 tackles for loss, 8 sacks, 4 interceptions. He can play all over the field, and he's just an exciting prospect.
And again, going to the three critical factors for him, pass coverage, play speed, FBI, what do you got?
Yeah, he's got a 6 in pass coverage, a 7 in play speed, and a 6 in FBI instincts. So like I mentioned earlier, he's a very well-rounded prospect. His play speed is his instinctiveness all over the field kind of go together. He's willing to cover sideline to sideline, and he's really aggressive when attacking the backfield. Like I mentioned earlier, 22 tackles for loss. He wants to hunt in the backfield, and he's really good at getting to the ball carrier at a blazing speed. And obviously, his background as a safety shows his ability in pass coverage, even though he wasn't always asked to do that. One of the more interesting aspects about him, as we just saw this last year with Micah Parsons, is his ability to rush the passer. He's a guy, depending on how teams want to use him, he's going to be a guy you could throw in coverage, and he could win numerous matchups, but he's also a guy that can really win against offensive linemen. He's not just a guy that blitzes casually and, will get stood up. He's a guy that can attack the line and get home to a quarterback a lot more frequently than other players at his position.
You mentioned a certain name there, Micah Parsons, that's going to get people thinking, but I got to say, from looking at the stat page, I'm especially intrigued by what he is as a pass defender. Amongst linebackers, we had him 3rd in the FBS in points saved in pass defense. And the crazy thing, when you start to look at when he was actually targeted, he had 22 targets where he was the primary defender last year. And not only did the offense create negative value on those plays, but it was positive percentage was under 23%. That's like ridiculously low. And actually his bust rate was 32%. So the plays were more likely to go for a major loss than they were to go for a modest gain when he was targeted there. So pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, like I said, his background as a safety played a role in that. He's very comfortable in zone coverage. Some linebackers like to just play that second level and kind of outside the tackle box where they can feel comfortable. But he's willing to go sideline. He'll even drop deep if he needs to. His man coverage experience at Utah is a little limited with their system because, again, in most of those scenarios, they're actually having him rush, which is why teams are going to be exciting. So I don't want to convince people he's not Micah Parsons. It's a different player, but he's got some aspects to his game that are reminiscent with the ability to cover, receivers, even tight ends and running backs for sure out of the backfield. And even some receivers are going to find it difficult to separate from him.
Was there a positional factor that stood out?
I'd say the entire process of him closing to a running back. So I'll classify that as tackling. His tackling, once he gets you in his grasp, you're going down. But it's the speed to get there in the first place, the reaction ability to actually recognize what's going on, and then the tackling ability to finish off the play. He's not a guy that messes around on the field. He's willing to cut through the line and be in the backfield before the offense even knows what's going on. That being said, there are some aspects to his game where he could use a tick more experience. One of the things, he just doesn't always trust his instincts, which is kind of amazing when you watch him play. He's really, really instinctive, but sometimes he reads the play and will take an extra half second before he wants to actually attack. When offensive linemen are coming to the second level, he would rather go around them than through them, despite his size. He's just over about 240 pounds. So he has the size to handle offensive linemen, but he has to be a little more aggressive in those scenarios. But when he's out in the open field, he's dangerous.
What you just said before about the half second and the instincts, explain to the person that's listening, who's not necessarily watching every play of every game for that player, how you figure that out.
So when he reads a play and trusts his instincts, he's on the ball carrier immediately. He's making big plays, and those are the plays you're going to notice on the team. The broadcast will go crazy. They'll show highlights. So that's what's great about him. When he's a half second slow, you'll kind of see him hesitate on a run maybe to the outside where he thinks, you know, there might be something coming back. He sometimes, I think, overthinks plays, and that's kind of where you get that delayed reaction. So a play where you would expect him, again, just seeing plays in a game where he makes plays behind the line, they run a similar play, and he won't make the same play. He'll make it at the line of scrimmage or maybe down the field because he reacts a little slow. You kind of see him hesitate and doesn't run immediately to the ball carrier in that scenario.
Jeff, you were on the front of the bandwagon talking about Owosu Koromoa last year. How does this player compare to that player? Are we talking about somebody that's a similar prospect, or is this somebody that's a totally different flavor?
I like the similar impact to the team for both of those. I think they both have the same level of impact on team. However, they are a little different. Owosu Koromoa is a little better in space, a little more of an outside coverage guy. Devin Lloyd is a guy that's, you know, built to kind of handle the edge of the box. You know, I think he fits best as a 4-3 will. However, there's some really intriguing matchups if you put him as a 3-4 linebacker and kind of where he can rush the passer a little more as well. So I think he's got a little more scheme fit depending on what teams do. Jeremiah Owusu-Koromoa, I think, was really good out in space. However, right, I think they both are going to provide massive value to their team.
But JOK is more kind of, the little bit more of the space player. He's a little bit more kind of a true outside linebacker fit regardless of the scheme.
Exactly.
Where did you have him, your final grade?
I ended up going 6'8". He's going to be a real solid starter at the start of his second year. I also, this would be my favorite, almost no matter what scheme he goes to be the favorite for defensive rookie of the year. There are a couple guys that are definitely going to get the notoriety right at the front. Green Hutchinson, Thibodeau, all those guys definitely worthy of that. However, as we just saw last year, kind of linebackers can do a lot on the field at once. The learning curve is a little different for linebackers, and Devin Lloyd already has mastered the football intelligence aspect of this game. And so once he just trusts his instincts and is willing to play to his potential, he's going to be a devastating force. He's got Pro Bowl potential written all over him.
All right, so we got the four players. We picked four that our guys were clearly very enthusiastic about, which is great. Give you guys a chance to articulate on them. Give the listeners a chance to have some players that they can root for their team to take, certainly in the upcoming NFL draft. Matt, you want to close this out?
Yeah, I mean, for 268 players, listen, NFL teams, they're all going to have similar grading scales. They're grading similar traits. Different teams look at it differently. Like, if you hadn't listened last week, I thought the guys did a great job of breaking down kind of scheme-based versus round-based grading and how that all works. But at the end of the day, no matter what team you're talking about, that's sort of a grade. That's a high-end grade. We're talking about top half of the first round type of grade, you know, depending on what the talent is like around them and how those positions are valued in that particular draft. So I really appreciate you guys coming on, telling us about these players, and especially being able to paint such a good picture of them. Because to me, that's what scouting's all about. That's the art that goes along with the science that me and Mark are constantly talking about every week, but the art of being able to paint a picture and explain who the player really is and how they fit into the context of where they came from and where they're going. That's the beauty of scouting. So thank you guys.
Yep. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
You just heard Jeff Dean talking about Playing in Space. Playing in Space happens to be the name of our basketball podcast. It's an NBA-focused podcast hosted by SIS basketball strategy analyst Henry Ward. The show covers the NBA through conversations on league-wide trends through a philosophical lens, driven by insights derived from SIS's NBA data. From discussions of player and team performance to basketball decision-making theory, Playing in Space has you covered on all Ideas NBA weekly episodes. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. For Matt, Ben, Jeff, and our producer, Justin Stein, thank you for listening to the Off the Charts Football Podcast. I'm Mark Simon.